The subject tonight is love. Hafiz, who is a Sufi poet, had this to say. The subject tonight is love. And for tomorrow night as well. As a matter of fact, I know no better hope for us to discuss until we all die. The subject tonight is love. And for tomorrow night as well, as a matter of fact, I know no better hope for us to discuss until we all die. If I were to ask each of you what is love, you'd all have an idea about it. It's hard to talk about love without talking about ideas, even though love is one of the most fundamental pieces of our existence, of our being. What is love? What does love feel like? What does it feel like? How do you know love? We know we want it, whatever it is. Why do we want it? What does it feel like to give it? Love, love. You know, there's so many ideas about love. But the question is, what is it? How does it feel? Is it a feeling? Is love a feeling? Is it a noun or a verb, right? Is it action? Is it something that you receive? Is it something that you give? How is the love of a mother for a child different than the love between lovers? Is it the same? Can you love a stranger? How do you know? How do you know? Is love the same thing as happiness? Is there certainly a myth that if love is present, then we are happy? Could be a true myth. I think it is a true myth. I've become quite close to a woman in hospice who is dying of cancer. She has stomach cancer. And she's also a diagnosed paranoid schizophrenic. We're talking serious paranoia here, you know, the kind that believes that there are massive conspiracies directed against her. And she has these paranoid fantasies a lot. And so the story about her is that she's very manipulative, right? Everybody says, well, she's really good at manipulating you and be very careful. It was all a story built on distrust. So it's not so much that she had a lot of power to manipulate, you understand, but she gave people the feeling that she was somehow forcing them to do something. And mostly it had to do with the feeling they got of great discomfort when they were talking to her. So one day I walked by her bed and I said, ooh, you look really sad. And she did. She looked very, very sad. And she said, oh, no, I'm fine. But don't touch my bed. I think I actually sat on the edge of her bed, which is, I never get close to her bed now, and this is many months later. So this was her space, and I had invaded her space, and not only was I invading her space, but I was telling her she was sad, and she just denied it categorically, and I popped up and apologized for sitting on the bed and said, well, how about if I just sit here with you? No. Well, if you want to. So I sat down, and I decided to stick with my original question, which was, why was she sad? And I also decided to listen with my heart and not my head, to not think about what she was saying, but simply to listen from my heart. And what this required, she told me amazing paranoid stories. But what I did was not really listen too much to her reality, but pay attention to the reality as she saw it, which was that she was in great pain and fear. A lot of fear and a lot of pain, a lot of suffering. And by connecting with that part in her, she felt seen. Now, I'm not going to tell you that this was easy, because my mind was going, I got to fix this, you know, I know this isn't true, I got to tell her this isn't true, you don't need to be worried about this, this is not happening, President Bush is not out to get you. But I didn't do any of that. I just listened and said, oh my God, that must really hurt. And she really felt seen. And the consequence of that is that she and I have gotten to be very close. There's a certain amount of honesty and trust that's been built up by virtue of my suspending my mind, just not letting it have the upper hand, and just meeting her at that place of pain. And that meeting her at that place of pain was really about love. What's developed out of that is that I really love this woman. She's remarkable. She's truly remarkable. She's very bright. And you can almost forget until she spins off into one of her stories. We had her come to the Zen Hospice Project training for new volunteers. There's always a representative from a residence that comes and talks about what it's like. And everybody was very worried about her. You know, well, she's going to go off into one of these stories. Everybody's going to think she's nuts, and it's going to be not a good... She's not going to be able to really talk about the great work we do. Well, she was remarkable, truly remarkable. And she said something that really stuck with me. She said, you know, I've been homeless for 15 years. And now the volunteers are my family. And I don't know what they think about me. And that's really scary. And what she was really expressing was everybody's fear, the same fear we all have. If I let you get close to me, you might hurt me. You know, that's really where we meet love most of the time. Is I'm not going to let you get close to me because then I'm vulnerable and anything could happen and that's not a good thing. And that's what she was doing. However, a few days later, we were talking about love, she and I. I don't know why it came up, but it did. And she said, you know, I'm incapable of love. I said, how do you know you're incapable of love? She has lots of stories about her kids, and she's been out of touch with her kids for 20 years. And she's a divorced woman. And she said, no, I'm not capable of love. And then she spun off into some paranoid fantasy, which just, when I said why, then she went on to talk about something that was totally unrelated. But what I know about her is since she's been on the ward, she starts taking care of everybody. She worries about everybody. She tells the nurses and the nurses' assistants, you know, you've got to take care of so-and-so, she needs such-and-such. And she's become someone who really nurtures everyone in the place. There's another woman who has a form of dementia that causes her to cry a lot, and she'll moan and she'll it can be quite annoying, right? So they were thinking of moving her to another ward where vocal demented people could be, and my friend was incensed about this. She said, no, she has to stay here. I understand, she keeps me awake a lot, but it's not her fault. It's not her fault. And it made me realize that what she was seeing was this woman. She was seeing her and not treating her like the woman across the aisle that's making all this noise and keeping me from sleeping. And it's this quality of being able to see that I think is what makes us open to love. It doesn't have anything to do with whether we like it, we don't like it, It has to do with being able to see what's really true. So my friend can't talk about love, but she knows it. She can feel it. She can act out of it. So does love hurt? What's the relationship between love and pain? I think there are two characteristics that we can notice. One is the characteristic of empathy, and the other is the characteristic of loss. So empathy is that quality that allows us to see someone else and to feel what it is they're feeling. So it's not feeling about them, it's feeling with them. It's really that joining with them, it's being connected to them. And that can be painful. Because what happened between me and my friend was that I was able to feel her pain. I was able to sit there with her and say, oh my God, it would be terrible to go through my whole life believing this. It would just be terrible. I don't know how I would do that. And that was something that gave us a place where we were the same. It gave us a place where we could recognize one another. The other part of loss, the other aspect of pain and love is loss. And we have a great fear of losing love, whatever it is. So rather than losing it, I don't even want to know it. I don't want to be there. I can't deal with it. And that's part of what my friend was saying when she said, you know, the volunteers become your family and I don't know what they think about me. It's a difficult place to operate from. So I have a story to tell you about seven monks in a cave. So there, these seven monks, you know, some Asian country long, long ago, these seven monks have found a cave that they lived in and they were meditating on the on unconditional love. So there was the head monk, his brother, his best friend, his enemy. This was somebody he just couldn't seem to get along with. There was someone who was very ill and very close to death. There was an old monk. And then there was someone that was called the useless monk. He had a lot of trouble with things like, you know, snoring during meditation, and he couldn't keep his robes on straight, and he couldn't get his chant straight, and then he would chant off key. And the other monks tolerated him and thanked him for teaching them patience. Okay, so here are the seven characters, and they're all in this cave. Well, this cave is discovered by a group of bandits. And the bandits decide this is such a great place. It's well sheltered. It's off in the boonies. Nobody knows where it is. And they're going to take over the cave. And in taking over the cave, they are going to kill all the monks. So the head monk, who is a very persuasive guy, goes to them and negotiates. And he says, you know, it's really not necessary to kill all the monks. So at the end of this time, what he is able to negotiate is that they'll kill one monk as a warning. And he, the head monk, has to decide who that's going to be. Okay, so here are the seven. There's the head monk, the brother, the best friend, the enemy, the sick monk, the old monk, and the useless monk. So what do you think he decided? Any guesses? Tough decision, right? How do you decide? How do you place that value? Okay. Well, he couldn't decide. He couldn't decide. He loved his brother. and his enemy in the same way. He truly believed, he truly felt that his heart was open to them, whoever they were and whatever they were doing, and he could not choose. He just didn't. For him, there was no way that he could say that person is better than the other person. And remarkably, that included himself. He didn't sacrifice himself either. He loved himself. He gave himself that unconditional love as well. Unconditional, non-discriminating love. Just there. Does that seem impossible? In the Judeo-Christian tradition, we hear love thy neighbor as thyself. Not more than, not less than, as thyself, right? It's having a regard for others and for yourself that's equal. It's an unconditional regard. It's this unconditional love that I think really represents what love is. That it isn't, I love you because I get this from you. Because I love you, you're going to do this. It's just there. Total acceptance. The door of my heart is always open to you. Always open. And the door of my heart is always open to me. To me. So I'm not going to say that it's that I don't love myself, that I can't love myself, that I am not worthy of this, that I am less because you are more. Doesn't mean I don't have faults. Doesn't mean I don't have things I'd like to improve about myself. It only means that I accept that this is who I am and how I am, and that I accept this is how you are and who you are. And that's unconditional. It doesn't have to do with what you give me or whether I like you or not. You know, I think there's a tendency to think that love is an extension of like. It's sort of a gigantic like. If I like enough, it becomes love, right? I don't think so. I don't think that love truly has, that there's any particular advantage to liking when you're talking about love. It might seem that it's easier, but it's not really where love comes from. In order to love ourselves, we have to accept ourselves. And what that means is we have to forgive ourselves for all the imperfections that we have. That's really what acceptance is. Okay, I've done all these screw-ups. Really have done some really dumb things. But irrespective of the value judgment of whether they were good or bad or stupid or ugly or wonderful, I can accept me. I can just accept. I can just say, that's okay. Here I am. Here I am. And nothing is getting in the way of that. What it means is that we come to be at ease with ourselves. Not complacent, just at ease. A natural being who we are. Being us. Being. Being. That's it. All. When we can do that, it's as if a part of ourselves that we had rejected and never accepted is kind of brought in from the cold. Here, come in, come in, come in. It doesn't mean you have to be perfect. None of us is perfect, and I don't really think I'll ever be perfect. But I can accept me. I can be with me. And I can be comfortable with that. That's where I want to live, is in that feeling of being comfortable. So what happens that that doesn't happen? Why don't I feel at ease with myself? Why don't I feel at ease with you? What is it that's in between? What is it that stops that from happening? I think that it has to do with separation. It has to do with creating something that's separate. Whether I create myself as something separate, or I create you as something separate, where we start making differences. I'm who I am because I'm not like that, and I am like that, and I didn't used to be like that, but now I'm like this. So I create a self. And in creating that self, I'm separating myself from you. I'm not like you. I'm actually shorter than you, right? Or whatever it is, right? This is how we create ourselves, is we separate ourselves from other people. It's all about a question of judgment. We start looking at things and liking them or not liking them. Everything that we experience in our lives, we form an opinion about it. We have a preference or a non-preference. I like, I don't like. I like, I don't like. Or I'm neutral. I don't have an opinion. In that space, that's where you start making the judgments, and that's where you start making the separations. And that's what's splitting us apart. So I want to do a little exercise here. We're going to do a hand exercise. So this is easy. I want you to put out your left hand. Don't put it too far. Because what you're going to do is take your right hand and put it on top of your left hand. All right, now, what I want you to do is feel your left hand from the point of view of your right hand. Notice the warmth, the texture. Feel the left hand from the point of view of the right hand. Okay. So imagine that you're touching your lover's hand, but it's your hand. You just feel it and notice what that feeling is like. Okay, now without moving your hands, put your attention on your left hand and feel the right hand. All right. So now you want to feel the right hand. Okay. So in doing this, what did you notice? When your right hand is on top of the left hand, and you're feeling the left hand with your right hand, your attention is in that right hand. And the left hand feels like it belongs, it's other, you know? It's sort of independent of the right hand, right? The right hand is where you're living right now. But when you switch your attention the other way around, now you're trying to feel the right hand. Now it's the right hand that is other. We haven't done anything. The hands are both you. And all you switched was your mind. And it's this changing perception that is the key to understanding the differences that you have. It's not getting lost in that sense of separation. It's when we're close to someone that we can love them. And when we're separate from them, we can't love them. To find your heart, you have to lose your head. Not that the head isn't very valuable. But sometimes forgetting what you know about something is the trick to actually seeing what's there. So a large part of this separation has to do with making decisions about something that's happening. A very useful exercise is to notice all the things that you like and don't like, which is pretty much everything. So it's a full-time job. But if you notice, oh, I really like that, watch then what happens when you're around something you really like. You kind of lean toward it. This friend of mine that I was telling you about earlier today was telling me that she really liked dark Italian men with certain kinds of noses. She really liked them. So I asked her who she knew that was like that. Nobody. Nobody. But she knew she liked that. That was something that drew her in. That was great. And so when you see something that you like, you're drawn toward it and you start making assumptions about what that is. And when you see something you don't like, the opposite is true. I could kind of leave that alone. Doesn't mean you're pushing it away necessarily or fighting with it. You're just sort of, I could do without that. And all of those things are creating false pictures of what's true. So in order to be connected with someone, what we really need to do is see things as they really are, as opposed to reacting to what I think my preference is. I like this, I don't like this, I'm neutral. I have no opinion about that. Sometimes being with something that we don't like can lead to love because we're seeing something from another perspective. So I'm going to give you an example. There was another guy that was in hospice who was, I'm going to call him Harvey. He was someone that I avoided. Harvey, I don't even know what his disease was. I don't know what he was dying of. But he was also schizophrenic, and he was an alcoholic. And he had a physical disability that, where his this is going to make some noise for a moment. His chin would be down like this. So he'd shuffle along the floor with his chin on his chest. And he drooled. And several of the other volunteers really loved him. They loved spending time with him. They thought he was really great, and they worried about him. And I thought, oh boy, I'm glad somebody's dealing with him, because I just didn't want to be around him. I didn't have anything against him. I just was glad somebody else was doing that. So he had a birthday, and we gave him a birthday party. And he was sitting there in front of his cake, and the person who organized the birthday party gave me his card and said, here, open his card for him. I opened the card. And one of the other residents was going, he can open his own card. He doesn't need you to open his card. And I thought, well, she's right about that. Next thing the organizer was saying, here, open his present for him. Open his present for him. And the other person said, do not open his present for him. And I thought, you know, she's right. So I didn't open the present for him, but the organizer opened the present for him. So he's sitting here, and his cake had red frosting on it. And by the end of the party, he had red frosting all over his clothes. And he was sitting there staring at his present, which was a couple of packs of cigarettes. And everybody had gone. And I was there with him. And I was feeling bad because he wasn't ready to leave. But everybody had finished their cake and they left. And he's sitting there trying to have his birthday. So I went and got him a cup of coffee. And now, I'd never spoken to him, had no relationship with him. Brought him his cup of coffee, And I'm thinking, okay. He starts drinking his cup of coffee. And I'm kind of sitting there just because I think, you know, somebody ought to be sitting with him. And then he throws up. He stood up. He walked over to the wall and put his head against the wall and just stood there. He was so humiliated. And I thought, I know that feeling, that horrible sense of humiliation. Ooh. And it broke me open. I no longer saw him as someone else who was this difficult, inconvenient person. I was right there with him in that humiliated state thinking, oh, shit, this is terrible. I went over and I cleaned him up and I took him, got him some fresh clothes, and he was so grateful that I was embarrassed. I was embarrassed. That, you know, it was an honor for me to be with him. And up to that point, I'd never made any connection with him at all. And the quality of love that arose out of my identifying with him and not seeing us as separate and him as different from me or me different from him. It was realizing that we were the same. Not that there were no differences between us, but that the separation did not exist between us. That wasn't there. And that brought love. And that was such a teaching for me, this man. This broken down alcoholic who could barely shuffle around, who drooled, who couldn't carry on a conversation, taught me about separation. He was wonderful. He was wonderful. What I think is needed is for us to notice when we're separating ourselves from people and what the causes of those separations are. Just to notice. Doesn't mean that we have to change anything. It's not like I've become a saint because I knew Harvey. But he has made me realize that decisions I make about what I like and don't like are just opinions, and they may not be based in reality. They may not be based on anything that has any true meaning. And that the real source of ease in my life has to do with acceptance on a very basic level. Acceptance of things as they truly are, without making separations between people. Thomas Keating was a Catholic philosopher. He said, silence the emotional programs that sustain who you think you are. Allow the ego's self-reflective apparatus to fade out. Put aside that false self based on childhood emotions, the reaching out for happiness, security, approval, affection, esteem, all those exaggerated needs we impose on others. And just do nothing. Let love be not what you are willing to do, but what you are willing to receive. Let love be not what you are willing to do, but what you're willing to receive. To send love to another, we must first be in our hearts, in our own hearts. So here's a poem by Stephen Levine called Meditation Blues. Sometimes it breaks my heart to watch my mind. Cold self-interest, insistent fear and judgment, whispered insults, vengeful fantasies, triumph and despair. A conditioned unfolding so impersonal, we take it personally. Sometimes aghast at the casual cruelty of even minor fears and celebrations. Sometimes it breaks my heart to watch my mind. And sometimes it stays broken long enough to touch even this pain with love. Sometimes the mercy washes even Mrs. Macbeth's hands, turns tragedy to grace, and makes it all worthwhile. Sometimes it breaks my mind to watch my heart. Sometimes it breaks my heart to watch my mind. Cold self-interest, insistent fear and judgment, whispered insults, vengeful fantasies, triumph and despair. A conditioned unfolding so impersonal, we take it personally. Sometimes aghast at the casual cruelty of even minor fears and celebrations. Sometimes it breaks my heart to watch my mind. And sometimes it stays broken long enough to touch even this pain with love. Sometimes the mercy washes even Mrs. Macbeth's hands, turns tragedy to grace, and makes it all worthwhile. Sometimes it breaks my mind to watch my heart. We have the train whistle. So, any comments, questions, discussion? What do you think?
I don't see her very much, and I was trying to see, she's coming out to see Granddad at a certain time, and I'm trying to see when is she going to come, because, see, I want to see her. I'm not so interested in seeing Granddad. Well, I am, but not really as much as I want to see her. I want to be there at the same time. And she says, I don't know, Mom. I don't know, because I'm going to be with Pat, the wife. I don't know. And, you know, and I was... And I said, well, can you tell me just, you know, those 3 days, what time would you kind of be there? That, and she said, I really don't know. I just don't know. And I said, well, okay then. But I know one thing for sure about me. I'm not going to be there. And I knew it was my ego. I mean, I don't see her. I haven't seen her for almost a year. And I really want to see her. And so, it's just that we're all kind of anxious and, you know, I don't know quite what I'm saying, but it's so appropriate what you're saying. Mm-hmm. I moved from my own self, ego, to realize that, you know, she's in troubled around all of this, and she's coming all the way out from Chicago and going to just be here for a few days. And also I have to remember that she's the one in the family that's the yogi, and she's always there, and she's always there with anybody who's dying. And she forgets how old I am, that I'm dying too. it's all mixed up. But anyway, I have to work with this, and I love that poem. You said Jack Kornfield wrote that?
No, that's Stephen Levine.
Oh, Stephen Levine. See, I get the mix. Stephen Levine, okay. Mm-hmm. Isn't that wonderful?
Mm-hmm. So you have to ask yourself, what do you want? You know?
What do I want, yeah. Mm-hmm. I just want to go hiking in the woods.
And you want to see your daughter.
And I want to see my daughter. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's a choice. Yeah. It's a little like the seven monks.
Yeah, I was saying to her, well, don't you know, I said, some people, you know, have a vigil, and they stay there all day. Mm-hmm. And she says, you know, I don't know, you know. I'm going to be with Pat. That's the father-in-law's wife now. And so then I was thinking, coming over here, I thought, well, you know, I could go do a vigil because I could be there all day with Granddad. I could do that. So, I don't know. I'll see.
You know, we all, on the scale of things that we like, don't like, and are neutral about, it's usually not so clear-cut that we can say, okay, I recognize, I like that. And it doesn't mean that you're not supposed to like it. Or to say, I don't like that, doesn't mean you're not supposed to not like it. We all have likes and dislikes. It's part of the differentiation of our lives. What makes a difference is whether we allow it to separate us from other people.
Can you do that again, please? I'm sorry.
Part of accepting myself is accepting that I like things, I don't like things, and I'm neutral about things. Once you recognize that, okay, I like this bowl, I like that sound, I don't like that sound, I can spend my time thinking about why I don't like that sound, or I can just say, oh, I don't like that sound. I don't have to be ruled by my preferences. I can notice them. It's important to notice them. It's an important part of mindfulness. I like this, I don't like this, I'm neutral about this. Where we get into trouble is when we start reifying those things, giving them a life of their own. The fact that we assign meaning. The fact that I don't like that means I have to do something about it. Wrong. The fact that I like that means I have to do something about it. No. Just means you like it. So it's sort of separating between the preference and the action. You don't have to be reactive. You don't have to follow through on everything you notice. You are not your thoughts. Very liberating idea. I am not my thoughts. I have lots of thoughts. Nor are you your emotions. It's another part of it, right? I have an emotion about, which is very, very strong in families. I saw something at Spirit Rock a few weeks ago that said, of course your family can push all your buttons. They put them there. Right? It doesn't mean that you don't have all of the reactions that you have, that you don't notice all of these things, that you suddenly stop being who you are. It just means that you make choices about what that information means. And you don't have to give it more meaning than it has.
You know, I just noticed that some resistance in me.
To the idea of empathy and feeling what another person feels. My 21-year-old daughter died of meningitis about 6 years ago, and we were very close. And also, even the love topic, you know, a lot of comes up. I know you wouldn't have said to this man, oh, I feel what you feel, but I also, in myself, have a resistance to the idea that empathy is exactly feeling what someone else feels. I didn't like it when people said to me, I know how you feel.
Right.
And I, even if they didn't say it, I don't like myself thinking that about anyone else. And I know it's my own prejudice and resistance, but I'm also drawn to empathy. You know, so it's a dilemma, but there's a fine line of not being that person.
I did not feel Harvey's humiliation. I felt my humiliation. I relived my humiliation,
yeah.
not his. And I think that's a distinction that you're making very, very appropriately.
Okay.
That I would never say to someone, I know how you feel, because I don't know.
Yeah. And I just don't even like people thinking it. You know what I mean?
Right.
I just think that's not...
Yeah. It wasn't that I knew how Harvey felt.
Yeah.
It's that seeing him and recognizing humiliation broke open my determination not to see him.
Okay, yeah.
That's what
yeah.
happened.
And I knew that. I just...
Well, I think it's an important... I'm glad you brought that up because it's true. You don't become the other person. That's not the idea.
Okay.
Yeah. I think that's important.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Thank you for bringing that up. Empathy is very tricky. It's very tricky. You know, a friend of mine that I saw a couple of weeks ago was here for a reunion. She lives down in L.A. And she told me, she said, when you came into the room, I started crying. And she said, I was so upset that I was crying. But she said, what was happening is there was just this energy moving through me. And she said, I don't know what it was. I just, oh, she said, it was love. You know? And there are all kinds of feelings that we have. There are energies that we receive. There are ideas that we have. None of them is really real. So the trick with empathy is not to go wallowing in someone else's feeling. That the value of empathy is being open to someone else's feeling and not shut off from it. So I think that's a distinction I'd like to make. So thank you.
On a much larger scale, I suppose, you know, I spend a lot of time reading the internet, and particularly newspapers and forums and blogs and whatnot about what's wrong with our, you know, the news and the global problems and whatnot. And every day I get this feeling that that's what the problem is that other people out there aren't connecting with other people, but they're doing everything they can to separate themselves and not empathize. They're apathetic to everything, like. I'm always asking, why aren't we rioting in the streets right now about everything that's going on? But it seems most people want to surround themselves with the things that they like, or, you know, be separate, be in their large safe cars and go to their homes and, you know, build fences and be away from everybody and everything. And so long as they're, you know, they have these superficial things that they like and, you know, minimize the things they dislike, that they're, you know, complacent and not really wanting to do anything about anything until, I don't know, say something they don't like the price of gas goes up. Then they feel motivated and proactive. And,
mm-hmm.
and so, you know, I don't know, kind of relates, I think, but it's just a thought.
Yeah, I agree with you. You know, let's see, what time is it? This is going to sound kind of strange, I think, but it's been on my mind the last couple of days. There, you know, the San Francisco magazine, that big slick magazine, used to be a small magazine, now it's this big consumer-based slick magazine. Well, we got our most recent one yesterday. And there's an article in this magazine about PUA's pickup artists. So there was a profile of this company called Pickup 101 that trains men to make connections with women so that they'll talk to them, so they can change the social dynamic between them. And there's a spectrum of these services that train people to be more attractive. that run from what seems kind of sleazy to, you know, a little more high-minded. But there was one quote in this article by one of the trainers, one of the PUAs, one of the pickup artists. And he said, well, you know, what it's really about is getting people out of their box, out of the box they've constructed around them, and connecting them with other people. So as politically incorrect as this whole idea of pickup 101 is to me, I liked that idea. I thought, okay, you know, that makes sense. Anything that allows people to stop being so isolated and somehow open up to other people can't be all bad. Can't be all bad. Well, I mean, you're dealing with motives, right? You're dealing with motives. So for some people, they've never been able to walk up to a stranger and say hello. And it's so liberating to be able to do that. To the extent that it becomes manipulative and you're manipulating people who maybe don't appreciate that they're being manipulated, yeah, it's a little uncomfortable. Exactly. So I told you it was a little off base, but it has to do with that connection and not putting yourself in a box. And one of the things that they train you to do is touch people. May you all be touched. Good night. Thank you.